No, that's going good.
Okay, welcome everybody. This is the office hours session for Austrian Economics 1, Praxeology through Price Theory, which is the Mises Academy course where we're going through the first four chapters of Man, Economy, and State. So we have some questions already in the queue, so why don't I jump on those. So first of all, Derek says, is there a point breakdown for the quizzes, tests, and whatever for the final grade, like a syllabus? No, there's not a syllabus that exists anywhere except in my mind, but the way it works is there's only going to be quizzes and a final, okay, because it takes me a long time to grade the pseudo-essay answers, and just the previous classes, I found if I did a midterm and then a final, it took me too long to stay on top of stuff. So there's just the quizzes and then the final. So the distribution of the points is going to be your total quiz grade is one-third of the final grade. So the quizzes are one-third, and then the final is two-thirds of the weight of your total grade for the class, again, assuming you're taking it for credit. And there's eight quizzes. So that means each quiz is worth, what, 1/24 of the final grade. So that's how it works. Also, I typed this out, but let me just say it. Some people were concerned saying, hey, you know, these quizzes are really simple. How do we separate the men from the boys in this class? So yeah, the function of the quizzes is just to ensure that you're doing the reading and watching the lectures. Okay, so I'll write, so the quizzes are supposed to be easy if you've done the reading and watched the lecture, and they're supposed to be hard if you haven't. Okay, so it's not even necessarily that I pick the quiz questions to be the things that are the most important ideas from the material for that week, but rather I try to come up with some stuff where if you're just coming in and haven't done the reading, that you probably aren't going to be able to just use your intelligence to get a good grade on the quiz. And I'm trying to really force you to go watch the lectures and so on. Okay? So then for the final, there I am trying to separate people out. And how can I put it? It's hard to say what you want to do. That, yeah, some people want something really challenging, but you got to keep in mind a lot of people who are signing up for these things, they're new to Austrian economics, and if I make this stuff too difficult, then, you know, they don't want to have a C on their transcript, as it were. All right, so it's hard to know how to scale the difficulty of it, especially when there's 200 people, and this is still, we've only been doing the academy for a year. It's kind of hard for us to calibrate these things. All right, so it is true. I'm probably erring on the side of making this stuff easier, but again, I have limited objectives with these things. I just want to make sure. If you get an A in this class, I want it to be for sure that you did a bunch of reading in Rothbard and you listened to my lectures and you understood the main points. Okay, and I don't think you could get an A without having done that stuff. I mean, maybe if you read Rothbard before, then you could get through without doing it this time, but that's fine. You know, so what I'm not doing in this class is trying to identify who the next hero of Austrian economics is going to be. That's not the function of these things, right? This is like economics 101. And if the next Nobel laureate is sitting in an economics 101 class in college, his professor might not even recognize him. And that's, well, for sure he's not going to recognize him because of the performance on the final exam. Maybe, you know, in terms of the questions the guy asks him or the girl after class or during class, you know, maybe the professor realizes, holy cow, this student is sharp. And that's the same thing here. I can tell in the, you know, the Moodle forum there, the questions for the professor, I can see some of you are really asking difficult, insightful questions. So, you know, if you're an overachiever and you want to be challenged, that's the place to do it. It's not because you're going to get 100% on the final, and somebody else is only making 84. You know that. So anyway, that's the way the class is structured in terms of the difficulty. Okay. All right. So now I'm moving back up to the top of the things here. So. Okay, so somebody asked me a legitimate question I can't find. Hang on, sorry everybody. I know somebody in the very beginning posted a question. I'm just not able to find it right now. Yeah, Jan, can you just repost it? Yeah, if any of you posted like a topical question, go ahead and just redo it, because now there's a lot of stuff in the queue and I'm having trouble finding it. Okay. So yeah, so Jan's gonna ask questions. So the rest of you who are tuned in right now, at this point, feel free to go ahead and type other stuff for follow-up questions. Okay, so Jan says, in the class you talked about the labor theory of value and how all costs eventually break down into labor costs. You then said it's wrong even on its own terms, but we don't have time to elaborate. Could you please explain now, is it because of time and / interest? Okay, so yeah, let me, hopefully I can do it. Yes, okay, so, and again, if you guys have other stuff you want to ask me, go ahead and post it, because that'll give me feedback as to how long I should take with these answers, because this is it's a flexible thing. Okay, so let me just refresh everybody's memory so we know the context. So you start out with a cost theory of value. And what you're doing is you're saying, and I'll just make up some numbers here. You're going to say, okay, that television set cost, plasma screen television set cost $500. Why? Okay, and so now I'm a cost theorist of value. And I say, oh, well, it's because the materials and stuff that went into it cost $1,000. So specifically it was $100 I had to pay the worker who took all the component materials and assembled them. You know, it took him 10 hours to put it all together, and I had to pay him $10 an hour. And so that was $100. And then the screen cost $50, and the other components cost this much, and And I just list a bunch of things that all add up to $500. And I said, so that's why the final price was $500, and part of that component would have to be I borrowed money from the bank to pay for all these factors up front, and then the time delay from when I got the revenue from the final customer, then I had to pay back the loan to the bank. And there was interest on it. So a part of that $500 would have to be the cost of the bank loan. Okay. So that's the way I do it. And I say, see, I just proved why, because if the costs were less than that, then I'd be making a pure profit. I'd be earning revenue over and above even the interest on the invested capital. And so other people would jump into this and they'd make more TVs, and that would push down the price of TVs and push up the price of the inputs. If I made less, or if it costs more than that, then, why would I be doing that? I'd get out of this business, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so there I've just shown you why the price of the TV is $500. It's because the costs to produce it are $500, considering all the relevant costs. Okay, so what I was pointing out is that the labor theory of value was breaking that down and saying, you can keep pushing that back and saying, okay, you've explained the price of the final consumer good, the television set, by reference to the labor at that last stage and by reference to the materials and so forth, but why was the price of that one circuit board, and that was one of the elements, and you said, oh, the price of that circuit board was $15 for the manufacturer who's making the TV set, but why is it $15? And then you could use the same reasoning, and you could say, oh, well, the reason that was $15 is that it takes $15 worth of inputs to make that transistor or circuit board. And part of it would be, you know, a dollar for the laborers who, you know, had to do some last-minute touches before that circuit board is now complete and ready to be sold to the TV manufacturer. And so that's $1, and then the other $14 are due to other stuff that goes into the production of circuit board. Okay, so you could keep pushing it back, and the labor theorist of value is going to keep doing that, and just he'll stop every time you hit labor. Okay, so each step that you push it back, there's less and less market value that needs to be explained. Like, so for example, with the TV, I think I said, I hope I'm getting my numbers straight, I think I said the TV was $500 and it was $100 worth of labor at last step, because I said you had to pay a worker $10 an hour and it took them 10 hours to actually assemble the TV with all the component parts. So at that point, now all that's left that's unexplained is the $400, right? Because we've explained 100 of it is due to the labor of the last guy who assembled the TV. And then you just keep going back step by step, and at each step, part of the input is hiring workers to work on, you know, the materials at that point in the production process to then, you know, make the thing get that much closer to the finished good. All right, and so there's less and less residual value that's flowing back in time into physical non-human things. And so the labor theorist of value thinks ultimately it all gets whittled away so that when all is said and done, the only thing you're really having to pay for is human labor. That ultimately, you know, and the sort of philosophy behind that is to say that nature doesn't charge us for her gifts. Okay, that it's true. Nature's not just going to give us an infinite amount of apples out of the ground or from a tree. You know, there's technological constraints that, you know, you have to put in so many apple seeds and fertilizer and rain and so forth. But the point is, we don't also then, when the apples start coming out, we don't have to, as human beings, pay money to nature to get them. No, we just take them. So nature gives us her bounty for free. And so the only real constraint on production in terms of money is having to get workers to be willing to sacrifice their leisure and to engage in labor, which is distasteful. And so that's, and according to the labor theory of value, that's the ultimate choke point, or I don't know what term you want to use, bottleneck in terms of restraining production. So that's ultimate. So ultimately, when you say, why is that TV set $500, they're going to say, because there's $500 of labor in that thing. So we already know there's 10 hours of labor at that last step, and that explained $100 of the $500 value. But then even of the other, so you might say, oh, no. So in other words, somebody says, hey, that television set's $500. That's because ultimately there's 50 hours worth of human labor congealed in that television set, and right now the market price of an hour of labor is $10. Okay, that's the way a labor theorist of value might talk. And so, you know, superficially, a critic might say, what are you talking about? It only took 10 hours to make that. And so only, you know, labor only explains $100 of its value. The other $400 isn't due to labor. It's due to stuff like the circuit boards and the, you know, whatever else you use to make a television set. And then the labor theorist of value would say, no. What I mean is, in the grand scheme of things, that look at, yeah, that circuit board costs $15, but we can ultimately decompose that into all the labor in the past that went into its production. Okay, so the way the labor theorist of value looks at the means of production is that, like, they're sort of congealed labor from the past. So looking at that circuit board, he might interpret that as a bunch of previous labor that sort of got stored or flowed into that thing. Okay, so that's the idea, and that ultimately you can explain the market price of everything by how much labor went into it. And strictly speaking, you know, Marx might talk about how much socially necessary labor. Okay, so it's so you can't just say, oh, well, what if everyone tied his hand behind his back and took twice as long to make stuff, but everything cost twice as much? You know, the Marxists would say, well, no, because that's not socially necessary labor, right? So they're not, I mean, they have ways of dealing with some of the more obvious objections to sort of save their worldview from critique. But what von Bavard pointed out, I don't know if Menger did, but for sure von Bavard was just brutal, assaulting the labor theory of value. And he said, no. First of all, you're completely overlooking the value of scarce natural resources. That, you know, if we talk about a copper mine or something, or, you know, deposits of oil, yeah, nature doesn't charge us for those things, but the owner does. The human being who legally owns the vat of, you know, the pool of oil, he owns 30,000 barrels of oil that are sitting on his property. That is a final step, you know, a last checkpoint in terms of breaking down the cost of production for various things. And it's completely arbitrary to say that his unwillingness to hand over those barrels of oil for free, that's perfectly analogous to a worker's unwillingness to go work in a factory for free, right? The worker owns a scarce productive thing, namely his labor power. And by the same token, the guy who has land and is sitting on a bunch of oil, he owns a scarce productive thing, namely barrels of crude oil. And, you know, the same principles apply there. It's true, him handing over the barrel of oil doesn't cause him physical pain the way that, you know, working in a factory kind of does, but by the same token, I mean, even if there's a worker who actually likes his job and finds it physically enjoyable, like a basketball player, someone who plays professional basketball, certainly, you know, withholds his labor not because of, oh man, are you telling me I have to go play in the championship game again? I hate doing that. I hate having a bunch of fans tell me how awesome I am and to be on TV and stuff. No, they are withholding, and, you know, they have their agent insist on multi-million dollar contracts because they know the market will bear that, and there's competition among various team owners for their services. Okay, so that analysis is the same thing with the guy who owns the crude oil. He's not going to sell it to this person over here for $10 a barrel when he knows the market will bear a price of $100 a barrel. That's not because it causes him physical discomfort to give it up. It's just because that's what he can get away with charging. So why wouldn't he? All right. So that's what I had in mind, Jan, when I said, even on its own terms, there are problems with the labor theory of value, that it erroneously elevates human labor to be like the ultimate scarce input when it's not. All natural resources are scarce in that respect. So what is true, especially in the Austrian tradition, is that capital goods are not, I mean, I don't want to say they're not scarce, but they're not scarce in that respect, okay, that you can explain the price of a capital good through that process of decomposing it into its constituent parts. Right, so for sure, I mean, this gets into my dissertation if you really want to get technical and look at it, but if everything is the same year after year, we're in a long-run stable equilibrium where it's just the same economy over and over, then it has to be true in that kind of world that the prices of capital goods are completely decomposable into the prices of the natural resources that go into them, including labor, and then, you know, the only gap then is due to time preference. Okay, got some more questions. But incidentally, Jan, if you're interested in this stuff, I strongly encourage you to read, if you haven't already, my critique of Kevin Carson's labor theory of value, because you can bombard, really. I have some quotes in there from him, if my memory serves. And it's, I mean, Bombard is underrated, all right? And people don't go back and read him because he's a bit difficult. Like, it's hard to get into his style. Like, he's... The way in which Mises is harder to read than Rothbard, well, Bombard is harder to read than Mises in the same way. But I would argue it's just as rewarding. Like, if you're willing to put in the effort to sort of get over the language barrier and the translated language barrier, I'm not saying go read it in the German. And if you can get into this, like, and get how Bombard writes and you understand where he's coming from, he's amazing. Like, he is an incredibly powerful analytical thinker. And when he wants to critique something, oh my gosh, he just blows it up. And then he builds it up again and blows it up a different way. Okay, so if you're interested in this stuff and you really want to understand modern subjective value theory, I would suggest that you go and read Bombard. And, you know, a good starting point to see, you know, gee, do I really want to get into this, is go look at that, my thing on the critique of Kevin Carson, because I think I have a little bit of Bombard quotes in there, and I show why Bombard thought the subjective theory of value was just a scientific advancement over the labor theory or the cost theory. In the sense that, just like, you know, Einstein's theory was a generalization and, in that sense, an improvement over Newtonian mechanics, by the same token, modern subjective value theory can explain everything that the sort of, you know, Smith-Ricardo long-run cost theory could explain, but it could also explain spot prices for unusual circumstances. Okay, Lewis says, when talking about the demand for money, is it more useful to use the approach of the concept that Rothbard introduces as total demand to hold? Yes, I think so. And so we'll get into that. Obviously, I don't know if you're just jumping ahead for next week's reading. I don't know when it kicks in. It'll be during this course at some point. But right. So there's two different ways we normally can talk about demand. The standard way, and the way that I think most people have in mind when they think of supply and demand. And again, for those of you who are hearing this after the fact, don't panic. We haven't hit this part yet in the book. We're still on chapter one. But later on, we'll get into it. That the standard way is that we're referring to people who don't possess units of the good and are trying to acquire them. And that's what we normally mean by the demand for something. So if we're talking about the demand for oil, we usually have in mind that there are some, you know, refineries out there, and they want to go on the market and buy oil because they don't have it, and they need to acquire it because then they want to take it and turn it into gasoline. Okay, and then the supply refers to the people who right now own the oil, possess it, and want to possibly exchange it for money. But an alternate way of looking at the concept of demand is called the total demand to hold. And so there, you look at, you're including not only the people who don't have it right now and want to get it, but you're including people who currently own units of the good and want to retain ownership. Okay, so that's why they call it the total demand to hold. So there, the idea is, you at any given moment, there are just so many units of the good that exist at that snapshot in time. And so we're not talking about producing more over a period. We're saying, no, if this right now, today at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, how many units of this particular good exist? And so that's just going to be some number that physically exists right then, right there. And then you say, okay, it has to be the case now, if we're in equilibrium, that various people, you know, the amount of units that they want to hold has to sum up to the total amount of units in existence. Otherwise, we're not in equilibrium. That means either people would want to hold more than exist, therefore they would want to hold fewer units than exist. Okay, so the price, the market price has to be such that every single person's desired quantity to hold all adds up to the actual amount that exists. Okay, because in reality, every unit has to be in somebody's possession. There's no such thing as a unit of a good that's just floating in legal limbo and somebody doesn't own it. All right, so when it comes to money, well, let me just back up. So in terms of like crude oil, so there, if you're some national oil company, like you're in the Saudi Arabian National Oil Company, and you have 10,000 barrels of oil in a particular deposit sitting under the underground, and based on the market price, you say, I'm going to only pump out 1,000 of those barrels and sell it, well, then you're holding still the other 9,000. Okay, so again, in a more conventional textbook analysis, normally we would just say, oh, you just supplied 10,000, and then if somebody else bought it, they demanded that 1,000. But here you're saying, no, of the 10,000 that exist, that producer wanted to retain ownership of 9,000. So their contribution to the total demand to hold would be they're demanding 9,000, and then somebody else who enters the market as a net buyer might demand the other 1,000 that they're selling. Okay, so that's the way you do it. So when it comes to money, that's a more natural, intuitive way to think about it, because you're thinking about there's a bunch of units of money that are in existence, and the purchasing power of money has to be such that people collectively in the community want to hold that many units of money. And that's the way you get equilibrium. Okay. So again, if I lost you, don't worry. We will cover this stuff once we hit that material explicitly. Okay. And the reason for that, in case you're curious, the reason that the more standard supply and demand framework is a more natural in one setting versus another, it has to do with if the good is really durable or not. Okay, so if you're talking about cartons of milk, it makes more sense to use the conventional analysis because the milk's going to go bad. It's going to expire. And so every period, there's the milk that it's basically you're just dealing with how much new milk is flowing into existence and what are we going to do with it, who's going to get it, and then it's going to be gone, and then next period the same thing's going to happen. Okay, whereas with money, even the people who buy money, and how do you buy money? Well, you sell goods and services to acquire units of money. You don't consume the money. It doesn't disappear. Right, so it's the same stock of money, or the stock could be growing, it's added to either by gold mining if we're talking about gold, or by the Fed doing stuff if we're talking about fiat money. But the point is, the money, when you buy money and acquire it, it doesn't get destroyed and wiped out of existence. It's just you're transferring the ownership of it, and so that's why for money, it's actually a little bit more intuitive to use the total demand to hold concept. Okay, so that's why the one versus the other framework is more intuitive. I mean, you could use either approach for either type of good. You could use a total demand to hold framework for cans of tuna fish or for cartons of milk. It would be a little bit awkward. And the same thing, you can use the standard framework with money. It's a little bit awkward because of the difference in durability. Okay. Jan says, are utility and satisfaction and value the same thing, and what is the relationship between them if not? Okay, that's a good question. Yeah, so let's see. It's ironic that you brought that up because I was literally just thinking about this before the lecture and whether this was going to come up or not. So historically, in terms of the development of subjective value theory, they're not the same thing. Okay, specifically, and I'm 95% sure that what I'm going to say now is correct. So for absolute sure, utility and value are distinct things in Bombavich's treatment. Okay, I think the Mises Institute, within the last few years, republished one of his, I don't know if it was a book or just a really long essay when he first put it out, but they call it, I think, something like Principles of Economic Value or something like that, and by Bombavich. And I got the, because, you know, Jeff Tucker was like, hey, do you want to review this for Mises.org? I said, oh, yeah, sure. And I got it, and I couldn't review it because I just got bogged down, and I realized, holy cow, I don't even know what Bombavich's talking about. Right? You know, in other words, I thought it was just going to be what the book was just Bombavich from step one walking through and explaining what was then the novel subjective value theory that his mentor, Carl Menger, basically invented. Right. Incidentally, just so you guys know, I mean, that Menger is a cool guy. That and it's not just because, and I'm not saying that just because I'm an Austrian. He founded the Austrian school. That in terms of the intellectual, just creation of a new paradigm, Menger is pretty special. It was I'm pretty sure it was Joseph Schumpeter who, in his own history of economic analysis, so Joseph Schumpeter wrote a history of economic thought book, you know, just discussing the development of various doctrines and stuff like that. And he said of Menger, what did he say? Shoot. And I forget the quote. Something along the lines like Menger had no father or something like that. I can't believe I'm botching the quote now after I set it up like that. What the heck did he say? Menger had no. Hang on, let me Google it and see if I can find it, because it was kind of a neat quote. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so Schumpeter said, Menger was nobody's pupil. Okay, so that's what Schumpeter meant by that was that it's not like Menger was taught economics by somebody and then it kind of just elaborated and refined it. But no, Menger just like out of nowhere, like sort of, you know, out of the brow of Zeus, created subjective value theory. Okay, now obviously that's an exaggeration. I mean, every thinker relies on the ideas that are lying around into which he's born. But you get the point that qualitatively, Menger just created something that was radically different. So Menger's pupil, so though Menger was the pupil of no one, Menger certainly had pupils, namely Bombavich and Wieser. So Bombavich was, you know, taking up the baton that Menger had passed to him, and in this book is developing, or like I said, it could have been a really long essay when Bombavich wrote it, but anyway, it republished as a book by the Mises Institute, and it explains value theory step by step from the ground floor. And like I said, I got it expecting it to be a real piece of cake and just, you know, nice exposition maybe with some illustration, you know, some numerical examples and stuff, because Bombavich uses those. And I just got bogged down because I said, holy cow, I don't even know what he's talking about here. Is that right? And I was getting all confused. But it was because he was worrying about objections that nowadays we don't even worry about, because we just take it for granted. And even, just to make sure you guys don't get confused, even mainstream neoclassical economists, like if you go to Harvard and their PhD program and learn economics, they would pay lip service to subjectivist value theory if they even understood what you meant by the term. Okay, so they would think that, oh yeah, we're subjectivists. We believe in the marginalist revolution just like you guys do. In fact, Leon Walras was one of the pioneers in that, and that's what we are. Okay, so they have utils and utility functions that are cardinal and all that stuff, but strictly speaking, if they know what they're talking about, if you're talking to a mainstream PhD economist who has done work in utility theory, they will say that, oh yeah, we know that utility, that preferences are cardinal rank, or sorry, ordinal rankings. It's just we, you know, as a matter of mathematical convenience, we have all these theorems that can, you know, summarize that information with utility functions, but there's nothing magical about the actual cardinal utils. Okay, so that's the way they would talk. So anyway, because right now nobody disputes that except like people coming from you know, outside of economics, like people working on I can't even think what the discipline would be, but people who do stuff like attach electrodes and stuff to your head and then like ask you questions or have you do tests and see if you lie to somebody or cheat or whatever and then look at your brain activity. I mean, those kind of people are trying to see, can they quantify, you know, what might be termed subjective satisfaction or something. Okay, so those people might think that there's such a thing as a cardinal unit of happiness, but that's not what modern economic theory thinks. Okay, so in that respect, the Austrians and the mainstream are in agreement. So my point is, we have lost the ability to even argue this stuff because nobody's challenged us on it in so long. Whereas von Bawerk, you know, he was still trying to sort of, you know, take the beachhead that Menger had captured and expanded. He was trying to solidify and elaborate on this relatively new subjective value theory. So, I'm coming back to answer your question. The one of the things I realized as I was getting into it is that von Bawerk was making a distinction between the terms utility and value. And to my ears, I had always used those interchangeably. But I thought, yeah, what's utility? Oh, it's the subjective happiness you get out of doing something. And what's the value? That's the same thing. And no, von Bawerk was being much more precise. So for von Bawerk, he was saying that utility is usefulness. And if you just think about it, that kind of makes sense, that the utility of something is how useful it is to you. Whereas value, that is clearly a subjective thing, and that is the relative importance that you place on something. That's what something's value is to you, is how important you consider it to be. And so you can see, so I think, now here I might be getting a little bit in dangerous territory, because again, I'm relying on the memory of something I read a few years ago and that I wasn't totally grasping at the time. But I think the distinction would go like this. So yes, value is dependent upon utility. If something had no utility for us, there would be no value in it, right? If something weren't useful, why would you care about it? And keep in mind, the usefulness, like even, you know, like you could say, well, what about a picture of my grandma? That's not useful, but yet I value it. Well, no, it's useful because it reminds you of your grandma. Or, you know, it's useful because it makes you feel good to know that you kept something from your grandma or whatever. So be clear here that utility doesn't just mean, you know, something hedonistic. It can be something spiritual, like a Bible could be useful to you as well, to record, you know, the words of the Lord or something. So, but to see the distinction, you know, I could have a bottle of water that's very useful to me, right? Because, oh yeah, if I'm thirsty, the bottle of water alleviates my thirst, but yet it would have a low value. And the reason, of course, is that the marginal utility of that bottle of water is quite low. Okay, so that's the sort of, I think, the way von Bawerk would parse it and handle those different concepts, is he would say that, you know, the value you ascribe to something is the importance you attribute to it, and that explains, that helps to explain market prices. But how do you attribute importance or value? It's based on something's marginal utility. And so the marginal, well, so for those of you who are hearing this, so Jan typed out, so marginal utility equals value. That's the thing. I don't think they do. I think it's more correct in von Bawerk's framework to say value is dependent on marginal utility, or marginal utility creates value or is the cause of value, but they're distinct things. All right? Just like, let me give you an analogy. How do we, as economists, how do we explain the prices that employers pay for workers? We'd say, oh, well, the employer, you know, he wants to produce a product, and then he says, okay, this particular worker, if he works for me for an hour, how much more product am I going to get, and then how much are consumers going to pay me for that? And so therefore, okay, that's how much I would value, you know, that's how much I value, I'd be willing to pay up that much for that extra hour of labor. So there, the term is marginal productivity. So the worker's marginal productivity says how much more product am I going to get because that worker contributes one more unit of input. Okay, but marginal productivity is not the same thing as my valuation of that hour of work as an employer. Okay, it explains why I value it, but it's not literally the same thing. Okay, so I think that's the distinction that von Bavrick makes. But you guys are right. I mean, before I read that stuff by von Bavrick, I would have used the phrase value and utility interchangeably. But I'm just saying von Bavrick was a lot more precise about these distinctions. Okay, and then you guys had also asked about satisfaction. Satisfaction, I think, for Mises and Rothbard refers to the, I guess like the subjective something. I don't want to use the word happiness because that's not really, well, I'm kind of walking around in circles because satisfaction is just meaning that, yeah, the subjective improvement in one's conditions because of some change that happened. Right, so I think probably it's, you would say that, and here I'm this I'm not as confident with. This is just, these are my words. Whereas the other stuff I said, I think is what von Bavrick would say. That yeah, so a good, you know, the fifth unit of apples has a certain marginal utility, and that it can alleviate hunger, and it also like provides taste and so on. And so it does provide some satisfactions, and that's why you value it a certain way. Okay, so I think those are three distinct concepts, but they're all closely related. Okay, but like I say, modern times, a lot of people don't really even worry about that stuff. But I think a lot of Austrian economists even would be a little bit flat-footed if you just put them on the spot, put a microphone in their hand and said, start talking to me about usefulness versus value versus utility. I think they'd be like, whoa, I thought those were all interchanging. It's okay. Let's see. There was one big one that I missed. Okay. So Derek says, can there be many different costs to an action? When you discussed this last lecture, you used the example of a woman getting married and said the financial cost didn't really capture the true cost of the action, but couldn't she have spent that money doing other things, hence many costs of getting married? Or is getting married and then making the decision on who to marry two different actions? Yeah, so it depends on how you want to frame it. So in theory, you could frame it as the woman deciding to get married versus staying single. And then as a subsequent thing, she says, okay, now that I've decided I'm going to get married, you know, which of these bozos am I going to pick? But probably, you know, strictly speaking, how would she know that she wanted to get married unless she already had some idea of what the outcome would be like? All right, so strictly speaking, I don't think that those are totally distinct and separate decisions. Because, in other words, it wouldn't be like, you say, okay, should I eat poison or shouldn't I? Yeah, I think I will eat poison. Now I've made that decision. What kind of poison should I eat? Well, gee, there's pros and cons. Of, you know, the rat poison is pretty tasty, but on the other hand, you know, it sort of gives you indigestion. So maybe I'll, you know, look at ant poison and you go through it. See, that's, you know, that in that sort of setting, it's weird. You say, well, no, you back up a step and say, why did you decide to eat poison in the first place? Okay, so the same thing. Yeah, you can imagine, you know, situations where that sort of logic seems fine, like to say, hey, let's go to the casino tonight, guys, okay? And then now that we've all decided we're gonna go, okay, well, who's gonna drive? You know, let's take Mark's van because it's got more room than my, you know, Camaro or whatever. But even there, again, if you were a bunch of, you know, if you guys were all stranded on a desert island somewhere, then you wouldn't say, hey guys, let's go to the casino tonight. Okay, how are we going to get there? You know what I mean? Like, so my point is, or if you know, if you're sitting around with your friends and you say, hey, let's get a pizza, and we can all agree, yeah, let's get a pizza. And then now we got to decide, okay, what toppings to get. It seems like those are sequential decisions. But again, even there, I think it's the reason it sounds natural is because we know, even as we're deciding, hey, do you guys want to get pizza tonight while we watch the football game, you kind of know that once we decide that, yeah, there's some other things we got to hammer out, you know, but that's not going to be an issue, okay? Whereas, again, you know, if you're a bunch of astronauts up in the space station and you say, hey, you guys want to get pizza, you're not just going to say, okay, sure, and then, oh, shoot, how are we going to get it? You know, because Domino's doesn't deliver up here. That you know, you wouldn't get past the first step because you'd say, what are you talking about? We can't have pizza. That's not even an option. Okay, so I guess what I'm getting at is whenever you try to analyze stuff in terms of a means-ends framework and then you want to say what are the benefits and what are the costs, you do have there's a certain framing issue involved, okay? And I'm just trying to give you different examples so you can see really what's going on, that ultimately whenever you're going to try to defer the ironing out of small little incidental details, that really only makes sense if the, you know, antecedent decision you kind of already anticipated and knew that stuff's going to work itself out. Okay, so let's see. And Lewis is coming back and saying it might also depend on the subjective appraisal concerning the social status of being married. Right, but I mean, even if we exaggerate it and you're trying to think of, well, no, like suppose some guy is an illegal immigrant and he knows that he's going to get deported unless he gets married. And so in his mind, well, you know, I have to get married. And now the question is just, how am I going to do it? Which person am I going to marry that's a naturalized citizen so that I can, or that is a citizen so that I can, you know, get in that way, stay in the country that way. Even there, again, that sounds fine to us, but it's only because of the relative issues involved. It sounds natural to us that for somebody who risks being deported, maybe the difference between marrying one person versus another versus staying single, those pale in comparison to the ability to stay in the country. Okay, so again, it's always the same framework that's involved. It's just in different circumstances, things might seem intuitively to us to be the relevant thing that the person clearly wants to deal with. Okay, you know, if you happen to be in some weird country where the only available people that you could marry were axe murderers or something, well, then maybe you wouldn't do that. Or maybe you'd make the decision to get married and say, okay, who do I want to marry? And then, oh my gosh, turns out the only people willing to agree to marry me are axe murderers, and so maybe I will just get deported. So, anyway, that's just showing you the difficulty with this stuff. And going back to the other part of your question in terms of the costs, strictly speaking, So you shouldn't have misunderstood. So don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that the money that is being spent on a wedding cake and sending out invitations, and, you know, weddings are ridiculously expensive. I'm not saying that those things are irrelevant. I'm just saying that that's not really, that when we're asking about the cost of an action in terms of subjective value theory, that's not the focus. It's not just a tallying up of the monetary expenses. Okay. The other thing going on there too is you have to be clear on who is bearing the cost. Right? So if it's the girl's father who's paying for all that stuff, and the girl would not otherwise have gotten the money, well, then the girl might not consider that as a cost of her decision. Okay, rather, the father is going to consider and say, okay, what's the cost to me of sending out the invitations, of paying for it, you know, to have the nice stuff, the calligraphy and all that stuff. I mean, it could cost a lot. Or, the, you know, to me, what's the cost of going with this particular florist to get all the flowers and everything for the wedding? There, I mean, the father might be reasoning and saying, well, what else could I do with this money? And then, you know, the benefits would be stuff like people are going to think I'm a cheapskate if my daughter's getting married and I don't spring for the flowers, or if I don't, you know, pay for a wedding cake or something like that. You know, and the benefits would be, too, that my daughter's going to talk to me for the next 2 years if I pay for her wedding, and, you know, she might not if I don't. Okay, so that's the kind of stuff that I mean, that you got to be careful that cost in the subjective value framework. You want to look at an action, and then what are, you know, what's, strictly speaking, you're going to say, if I choose action A, how much happiness am I going to have, all things considered? On the other hand, if I choose action B, C, D, E, F, I can think of the happiness I will have, all things considered, on those timelines, if you will. And then I pick the best one and say that's the benefits, or the, you know, that's the happiness I get. And then compared to if I didn't do anything in this respect. But then the cost is I look at the second best one. Okay, so you don't look at something really dumb you could have done and then say those are the costs of the action. You look at what's the next best thing I could have done. So if we all are, if we're assuming that the bride has all the money to start with and she's saying, okay, I'm going to choose to marry this guy and I'm going to spend $10,000 getting my dress and doing all this other stuff, then yeah, the next best thing, she's going to consider a world where, suppose the next best thing is she doesn't get married at all. Well, then in that timeline or that framework, in that alternate universe, she has an extra $10,000 in cash. And so she would also, when evaluating the happiness of her life if she remains single, part of the reason that that's going to be happy is she's going to have an extra $10,000. So that stuff all gets worked into the calculation, but my point is it's not just a monetary consideration. She thinks of subjectively, which timeline do I want to go down? You know, as I'm moving through my life and I'm making decisions and I'm branching off, going down one, you know, history versus another, every time I make a choice, I'm going one way or the other. And then to evaluate that choice, technically the relevant comparison is, suppose I had chosen differently, what is the best possible choice I could have made that's not the one that I didn't make? And then how happy would I have been had I done that? And that is the relevant benchmark to say, you know, the action you did do, was it the right thing to do? Or, you know, what were the benefits and the costs? Okay, so that's the idea. Okay, we probably have time for one more question. Okay, Jan says, Rothbard sometimes says that durable consumer goods, example a house, are similar to capital goods. How? Okay. Yeah, so I don't remember, I'm not doubting that you said that. I'm just saying I don't remember exactly where he said it. On page 65. Okay, hang on, let me just pull it up just so I not saying something dumb. Okay, whoa, when I see a thing for Firefox wanting to update, so let me make sure I tell it not to do that right now. Because that would be kind of catastrophic. Okay, so hang on, I'm pulling up Man Economy and State. And you, what page did you say it was? 65? Page 65 at the bottom? Okay, hang on. Let me just get to it. And then, yeah, this will have to be the last question. Oops. You have a huge book, moving the cursor down just an inch. Several hundred pages. Okay. Okay, the bottom is 65. Okay, it is clear that, so this is Rothbard, the bottom of 65. It is clear that the accumulated stock of capital goods, or for that matter, durable consumers' goods, imposes a conservative force on present-day action. The actor in the present is influenced by his or someone else's actions in the past, even if the latter were to some extent an error. Okay. Yeah, okay. I think I can answer your question more generally rather than focusing on that specific thing. So if you think about what is a capital good is something that allows us to produce consumers' goods, and it also is something that humans made. Okay, so a capital good is a factor of production. So the reason you want to have a capital good is it allows you to get consumer goods in your future sooner than you otherwise would be able to. And so in that respect, you know, it's in many ways, it's a lot of things that are true of capital goods are also going to be true of a durable consumer's good. Because a durable consumer's good is going to give you a flow of consumption over time in the future. Right? So if you have a house, you know, that will provide you with shelter not only today but also next year, the year after, the year after. Okay, so it's a very durable consumer's good. Just, you know, in a similar way that if you have a bunch of lumber and nails and hammers and so forth and paint and window panes, those are all capital goods. And they can provide you with shelter next year and the year after and so on once you build a house, okay? And you could come up with some example where you're not building the thing that you're talking about, okay? So that, I don't know if that's answering your question, but I think that's one sense in which capital goods and durable consumer goods in many situations are similar, is because a capital good is useful to you because it's going to provide consumer either, you know, services or goods down the road in the future, but so does a durable consumer's good. So the one difference is a durable consumer's good provides you with consumption right now as well. Okay, so that also works for the example he's talking about there. And then Jan says, so is that related to the fact that during a boom, people invested in houses, which is similar to investing in higher order capital goods? Yeah, exactly. That, and in fact, some Austrians might even classify a durable consumer's good as a capital good. Okay, so I'm not going to take a stand on that. It depends on how you want it. But, I mean, clearly, you know, a durable consumer's good, you can sell it down the road for money. And so in that sense, you know, it's kind of like a capital good. It's a means to an end, to some other end. All right, so once you own a durable consumer's good, you're not locked in to just receiving that flow of services. If you want to, you can sell the thing for money down the line and change it for something else. But for either way, however you classify it, it's true that lower interest rates, other things equal, you will be more likely to buy durable consumers goods. Okay, because the way you figure out what how you should value a durable consumer good is the same way you value a capital good. As you say, right now, what is my present valuation of the entire future flow of services attributable to this thing? And so the lower interest rates are, the less of a discount you put on future satisfaction. And so other things equal, the lower the interest rate, the higher the current market price of both capital goods and durable consumer goods. Okay. Well, why don't we stop there, everybody? Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you guys on Wednesday.